Welcome, twos and threes. As always, pleasure to have you with us gathering here. Today, we have a real privilege to actually introduce you both Gavin and Paula Daniel, people who are near and dear to my heart. I have the privilege of working closely with at Kingsway, the school where I'm working at. And I just think you're really going to love actually who they are, their heart, and actually the mark of God's grace and goodness and faithfulness in their life. Their story is just marked by, in so many instances, of the goodness of God. And I'm thankful, so privileged that you guys are actually here today, actually blessing us with that opportunity to hear that, and that you're willing to share that. Thank you. One more thank you, three more thank yous, five. as per usual, we'll start off with our intro. So Christine, if you don't mind.
Cool. Two or Three Gathered is a series of conversations with Christians, brothers and sisters, considering their efforts and contributions to the kingdom vocationally, their stories and testimonies of God's sovereignty and grace, and an opportunity to tackle the relevant issues the church faces in the 21st century.
In this, we seek to equip the saints by networking within the body, starting the conversation around often taboo subjects, and seeking to develop unity across Christian denominations and traditions by opening up discussion on worthy, necessary topics.
We want to help educate the wider body of Christ by asking these experts and people of wisdom across multiple fields the hot-button questions and sophisticated questions that we believe there are answers for in God's church, but that there is not necessarily always access to.
We want to further the growth of knowledge and wisdom in ourselves, to worship God with our minds and fellowship with all of you, as we collectively seek to discern what God glorifying discipleship looks for us in our respective vocations and in our spheres of influence.
It is our heart and hope that Christ himself would be in our midst as we converse about things we believe he himself is very interested in.
Welcome, twos and threes. Thank you for gathering with us. So guys, that is our intro. Thank you again for actually coming on. Five more thank yous. They're going to feature a lot in this podcast, I think. we're so excited to have you on and to actually share a little bit about yourselves. But before we get into the meat, you know, let's maybe do some milk. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are, maybe actually what our connection is, how we've met each other? More generally, just maybe we'll ask some, you know, icebreaker questions like every, say, church youth group does, you know, three truths and a lie, two truths and a lie.
Okay, you're going to go? I'm Gavin Daniel, and I'm a teacher at a school called Kingsway School. And so Jared and I are colleagues at that school, but I think we've become more than colleagues, we've become family. In the sense that we've formed a relationship with his dear wife and his little children and his extended family. And so it goes beyond just working together. Interesting thing about Jared and I is that we have our regular walks where we two guys take a walk at lunchtime and talk about life and just listen to each other and share. And I think that's such a beautiful thing that we do. I'm glad to be here today.
That's awesome. More guys need to do that. Guy walks. I like it.
Yeah, I should qualify. Like, you know, it's a lot of Gavin listening to me whine. Like, he's very pastoral and very wise.
And you're such a whiner, Jared. Like, seriously.
it's about being a good listener and then just coming in at the right point, you know.
And lovely Paula, please.
So I'm Gavin's wife, and we've been married for 26 years this year. And I also teach at Kingsway, and I have true favor in that I get to teach next door to my husband. Our classrooms are next door to each other, so it's pretty awesome. I'm living the dream.
Oh, no, actually, I'm living the dream, because while I'm busy teaching science, sometimes there's a knock on the door and there's a beautiful cupcake or a hamburger or something that comes in. And,
nice.
And then the kids in the class go, "No, that's not fair, Mr. Daniel. You get favored." I'm like, "Yeah, she's my wife, so you know."
And she's the cook, so what are you going to do?
I started relieving initially at Kingsway, and about 4 years ago, I started full-time. I had the privilege of meeting Steph, Jared's lovely wife, at while I was relieving, and I think it was her first year at Kingsway, and we just kind of just formed this instant friendship. And not only with her, but with her mom as well. And I think
Wait. Does Steph's mom work at Kingsway as well?
Yes.
This is like a whole little Christian commune thing going on here that I'm not a part of.
Cult.
Yeah. A little bit. Feeling a little bit left out here. Wow. I didn't even know Steph worked there as well. So there we go.
Yeah,
my goodness. Wow.
And just... basically just started doing life with Steph, and I think Anne is one of my best friends in New Zealand, and she's more like a sister to me, and and I have the privilege of baking Jared and Steph's beautiful for their beautiful
their wedding
cake. And the engagement cake.
And the baby shower cake. And
I'm feeling like I'm missing out on several cakes here. Yeah. Like, I'm forming a list.
Oh, because we should say that, because Paula, you used to professionally make cakes, isn't that correct as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So yeah. When I lived in South Africa, when I was pregnant for Jonathan, I decided that I couldn't have my last baby and be, working full time. And but that's another whole story altogether.
Mm.
And how I got to eventually leave teaching. And I had my business running for about 5 years.
Mm.
And and then we moved to come to New Zealand.
Mm.
Yeah.
So Paula literally gave up teaching and started her own business, which became really, really successful.
Mm.
If you wanted a cake from Paula, you had to book 3 months in advance, otherwise you would not be able to get a cake.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's true.
Wow. Do you have an Instagram of your cakes? I love looking at professional
baked
cakes.
Actually.
Oh, can we link that below? Because if there's anyone like me who needs to see cool cakes, we need to link that, I think.
Okay.
So I can go check them out. Yeah.
I'm aware because like we obviously know each other, Paula, Gavin, and like already you've endeared yourself to Christine, but you know, for the sake of our dear listeners, I want to give us a sense of trajectory. So like there's obviously a sense in which your story was distinct as you were, you know, younger, and then actually where your story converges. But I'm wondering if you can just talk to some of these things that are with a bit of a timeline, and you know, we can actually pick up on some things as we go. Like, because you mentioned South Africa, like it's curious to me, like I've never said this to you, like it amazed me getting to know you guys that I didn't know that there was a South African Indian community. Like no, I didn't. Shows my total naivety, uneducated.
Ignorance.
Like, I know, the worst.
But it's all good.
But I've always been fascinated, like if I wanted to ask you more about that. Like I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit, like going right back. Tell us a little
bit. Pre-marriage, the separate stories before you met.
Let's do it.
What was it like? Paint the picture for us. Were you living in a South African safari with the lions out the back? And you know, that's how I imagine it is anyway.
So I grew up wrestling lions and
knew it.
Knew it. I still have the scars, you know.
Of course.
Oh, I believe you. Totally. I'm there.
Life was tough there. You know, you just stepped out your door and then you don't know what you're gonna encounter.
Elephants, lions, bears.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll go first.
bring us back down to earth, Paula.
So I was born during the apartheid era. And apartheid, for those of you that don't know, means apartness, separate. All race groups were separated in terms of where they lived, where we schooled, that kind of thing. And I was raised in a very Orthodox Christian family and very strict. In terms of, we used to have Sunday school examinations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Otherwise, so, you don't go to heaven. If you fail, is that it? You're out. You didn't, yeah. Oh, wow. Gosh. So, Jesus, he's a hard headmaster.
So I think that church, I kind of grew up in the church because my dad was an elder and my mom was a Sunday school teacher. And I come from a family of, there were six of us. I had two brothers. I lost a brother about 25 years ago. And I'm the third. So I had my older brother, Reg. And then my sister Yvonne, myself, and my brother Elton. And my parents divorced when I was 9. And that was, there was a huge kind of stigma attached to my mom, because at the time we lived in an Indian community, and that was looked down upon. It was frowned upon that, you know, there was divorce.
Was that also from the Christian side as well?
No, I think that's from the Indian side.
From the Indian side, okay.
Yeah, more cultural.
Right, okay.
So my mom had a very hard life raising us. She had worked two jobs and, you know, we didn't really have much of a relationship with my dad. And not because my mom stopped it, but because my dad was just not interested. And it was hard being raised with people kind of look at you differently, you know. And but I have an amazing family whom we're very close to. I come from an extremely close-knit family. There's nothing that goes around that nobody does, that no one knows of. Everybody knows everything. And we had the support of my mom's family. And my mom is a real woman of substance. She raised us with Jesus at the forefront, the very center of our lives. We were raised with, you know, watching her strong faith and never failing faith in Jesus. And no matter how hard things got, we knew that, you know, regardless, Jesus was in control. God was the center of the head of our home, and that's how we were raised. And I was a naughty kid. And
aren't always the best teachers, they're always the naughty kids, you know, because they understand the naughty kids in class.
I kind of growing up, I think going through my teenage years, I kind of was a bit of a rebel with no cause. Started questioning a lot about our faith and looking, obviously learning more about my surroundings and living in apartheid South Africa and the unfairness of worshiping a white god, if I can say that.
You can definitely
And and I rebelled, became a real rebel in terms of my spirituality. I was just looking back, I was questioning and finding my way. But for my mom, I think it got her fears. Her fear gripped her. I was here as a child that she looked at. She didn't look at me looking for God. She looked at it rather than walking away from God.
Yeah.
So as a result, you know, I used to have the deacon and the pastor of our church come home quite often to have a chat with me. And And to make it and to make it a lot worse, in that I met Gavin when I was 16 years old and instantly knew that this was the man I was going to spend the rest of my life with.
Aw, bless. Sorry, that's super cute.
because God told you, right, Paula? No, I'm joking.
No, I think I have to be honest. I think it was the motorbike and the bad boy look.
The leather jacket.
That's awesome.
Get honest, yeah. Yeah, I met Gavin when I was 16 and our family became friends, but Gavin was Hindu. Oh. So, yeah. So,
wow. That must have been scary for your mum, for you falling in love with a Hindu boy.
Yeah, for my mom.
Yeah.
And for my family and
church and everyone except you.
Because can I ask a couple of clarifying questions there?
Yeah.
Like, so within the South African Indian community, there's obviously people, even under apartheid, you know, experiencing relative freedom to live based in their culture and in their religion. Is that correct? Like, you know, for both of you? Yeah. But there was, like, obviously Christian circles, like, in Christian context there within that as well. Like, go on, Christine.
So would your church be Indian Christian? There wouldn't be white Christian and black Christian and Indian. So it's definitely still separate.
Yeah.
Separate.
Right. Yes. Okay. Even within faith circles.
Even within faith circles.
So
right.
if I can come in now and just give you some context. So South Africa, South Africa was colonized by the Dutch in 1652, because what was happening was that the European traders were coming around the coast of Africa and going across to the east for spice, well, the spice route and the spice trade. And so those journeys and back in those days were so long that they had to find a way of getting a refreshment station. And so they decided to colonize the Cape, which is the tip of Africa, and make that their halfway stop. And so it became a Dutch colony, and then later, much later, it became a British colony. But to put it into context, how people of Indian origin got to South Africa was the British, when they arrived on the east coast of South Africa, and they colonized that part, they found out that the weather was really good. It was subtropical, and it was perfect for growing sugarcane. And so they wanted labor. They wanted laborers because they didn't want to do the work themselves. And so they looked at the local people called the Zulus. And the Zulu, in Zulu culture, men don't work. They hunt and defend the tribe. The women actually work on the fields. And so the British realized that they didn't have labor. And so what they did was they looked at one of their colonies. And one of the colonies at that time was India. And so what they did was they went to India and they literally lied to the Indians, saying that we're going to take you to this place far away on a ship. And when you get there, you're going to live in a beautiful land. We're going to give you lots of land to farm, and you're going to have your own space, and you can do whatever you want to. But it was all a big lie, just like slavery was a big lie. And so our forefathers, Paula and my forefathers, were taken to South Africa to basically become laborers. Mm-hmm. Where they worked on British farms for up to 16 hours a day.
Oh, and so that was slave labor? That wasn't paid labor?
Yeah, not paid labor.
Okay. It was paid. I mean, minimum pay. You
right.
know,
so, just, yeah, just above what slave labor above, was considered. Yeah, right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, okay. So that's the background of how we had the Indian culture, South African Indian culture that Jared was asking about earlier. But to bring that into the mix, then later on we had a change of government where we had the apartheid government that came into being. There was a party called the National Party that came into power. And so they believed in something called apartheid, which means to keep people apart.
And was that the Dutch government?
Or the British? It was.
Yeah, the time.
Boer War in there somewhere, wasn't there?
The Boer War was between the Dutch and the English. They were fighting over land. And then there was also the Zulu who owned the land that we're trying to defend their land. And so it was a big real mix, you know?
And the Indians are just sitting there going, we just wanted a farm.
We just wanted to do something quietly. Why did we come? Exactly. And and then the sad thing was that, so the National Party was much later. It was what we call an Afrikaans speaking party. So, and they believed in separate everything. So they separated people according to the color of their skin. And so we as so-called Indians were only allowed to live in a certain area. And if you were so-called Black African, then you could live in a certain area. And if you were white South African, you could live in a certain area.
Could I just, what date is that around? Just for the people who are watching, because that's not the 1600s, is it? That's
the 1940s.
That wasn't that long ago.
That is not that long ago. So that was the 1940s. But they were very good at how we call it the architects of apartheid. They were very good at how they did this, because they passed laws or brought laws into being where you were not allowed to marry across color line. So in other words, a Black person could marry a white person. You were not allowed to go to the same schools. You could not go on the same public transport. You were not allowed to go to the same restaurants. Swim in the same pool. Oh, it was so hilarious that even the ocean was separated.
They're not even allowed in the same bit of water.
Yeah. So if you were a South African Indian, you had to go to a South African Indian beach, which was ridiculous because it's the same ocean.
It sounds
insane. I was 10 years old and I asked my dad, we took a drive along the beach and I asked my dad if I could go for a swim. And he said to me, no, son, we can't, because this is a whites only beach. And I didn't understand what that meant. The term that they used wasn't whites. They used whites, or sometimes they said Europeans only.
How do you explain that to your kids? I mean, how do you tell your kids that they're not seen as the same? Like,
how do you as a kid understand this? Because I was a kid and I didn't understand this.
No.
The sad thing was that my grandfather owned a huge property. He was a very prosperous businessman. And then in the 1960s, his old family were literally removed from their property because they passed a law called the Group Areas Act, where certain areas were now declared white areas and certain areas were Black and certain areas were whatever.
And what, and the so, better areas, the white areas? Just out
oh,
of,
absolutely. Yeah, so yeah, my grandfather right, yeah. owned the prime land, and our family lost our entire wealth. Because the government just took everything away from us and basically sent us to a little dingy little place to go and live. So that is my memory of starting life in South Africa. It wasn't the best. You and I, Christine, could not have been friends then because it was not allowed. So
it's crazy. I mean, like, just my family has been in New Zealand since white people came to New Zealand, basically. But we were also responsible for owning land that was already owned by the Maori people, you know. And I look at this now and I'm horrified. You know, my mum is British. She's from England. And my dad is European Kiwi. And I look at it and I'm just like, I don't understand how my ancestors thought that somebody I can chat to like you guys was somehow less than them. You know, like, I just don't even understand. It's so...
well.
It's horrific to me that people can be treated like that.
It is horrific because one group of people felt that they were superior to another group of people. That's the basis of it all.
And it makes me ashamed to, like, I know it's not my fault, but it makes me ashamed that I come from that history. Yeah. You know, like, it does make me go, oh, my people got it seriously screwed up. You know, like, anyway, sorry.
Well, especially
that's my own personal apology.
let's both of them disclaim that, eh? Like, we are sorry for our parts. It's like, I do, Yeah, especially the stuff where it's done in the name of Christianity as well. Like, that's really particularly ugly.
Yeah, I think, Jared, you brought up an important point. So, you know, like Paula said, I was born into a Hindu family. And I always say to people, it wasn't my choice. It was the family that I was born into and the faith that I was born into. Yep. And so that was my normal. But when I was 7 years old, my best friend Lazarus invited me to church. And he came and asked my mom.
His name was Lazarus.
Lazarus, yeah.
Actually, Lazarus, that's the coolest. Oh, my goodness. That's awesome. Fantastic.
We're still best mates until today. And so he came to my mom and he asked my mom to if I could come to church. And my mom said, absolutely, you should take Gavin. And she wasn't, I was raised in a family where we were taught about other religions. And we were taught to understand and tolerate other religions and not to point fingers. In fact, Paula and I were having a conversation about that earlier today, about the fact that when you actually learn about other religions, you actually understand where they're coming from. You don't have to agree with them, but you actually understand them better.
Yeah. Do you think, is that part of Hindu culture and the fact that there are many gods in Hindu religion, does that make it more accepting of listening to other people's religions, or was that just a particular thing for your family?
I just have to clarify something, because there's also a misconception. I mean, me being a Hindu growing up in that, so in Hinduism, when they talk about many gods, they actually, what they're actually referring to is the many aspects of God. So
I thought it was actually lots of different gods.
No, so what happened was they if you understand the history of Hinduism, it started 5000 BC. So basically, it's a very, very old religion. And back in those days, there was no proper schooling, there was no proper education. So the people or the priests had to try and get people to understand how God operated. So God would God was responsible for, let's say, your prosperity, or God would be responsible for peace or whatever it might be. And so they created these images, which actually represented the aspects of God. And so that's where it actually comes from. But you are right, because my mom was a devout Hindu, but she had a Bible next to her bed, and she would read the Bible regularly. And so I grew up in with that. So I grew up knowing about Jesus. But I knew about Jesus, but I didn't know Jesus, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of people who grow up in churches who grow up knowing about Jesus and don't know Jesus. So,
So, I mean, I loved going to church as a child. I loved going to Sunday school, singing the songs. But like I'm saying, I didn't have a relationship with Jesus, but I knew about him. If you ask me, I mean, I actually read most of the stories of the Bible by the age of 10. Wow. So, I knew the Bible.
God was hunting you down, wasn't he?
From a very early age, yeah.
He was like, that Paula, she's going off the rails. We need Gavin. Come on, Gavin.
I think the problem was that my introduction to Christianity was not the best one, because the church that I went to, they preached mostly the fear of God more than the love of God. And so it was like, if you do this, you'll go to hell, if you do this, you'll go to heaven, kind of thing. So me and my tiny little head at 7 years old, I'm trying to, like, oh God, this God is going to send me to this bad place and I'm going to burn. And so, like, I was literally terrified at that stage. I didn't understand it, you know.
So then how old were you when you met Paula? Were you about 16 as well? Were you guys the same?
No, my friends. I shouldn't say this on here. Okay. So I was 22.
Oh! Look, I met my husband when I was 26 and he was 18. So it's fine.
My friends were teasing me and calling me a cradle snatcher.
I mean, 16, it's a little bit.
You may or may not have already talked to this a little bit, Paula, but I'm wondering, like, if you If your situation of actually growing up in that kind of context, we were talking about apartheid before, was it similar? Was it dissimilar? Completely different, you know, to Gavin's? What could you tell us about your experience of growing up in that context?
So Gav's family and my family were really, really different. Obviously not in just religious wise. They were, I think Gavin's family were very politically aware of a lot of stuff, and they things were very much in the open where they discussed and argued different points, and it was almost like encouraged, you know, healthy. I grew up in like I said, quite an orthodox kind of family. We weren't kind of allowed to question, and I remember as a little girl, for me, lots of things were quite normal. Like, I never thought about apartheid for a long time as a little girl. It never really, I just thought that's the way life was, you know, that's what I was born into. And because of not being around, nobody really discussed stuff with us, especially when it came to politics and whatever. So one of my first or earliest memories of apartheid was when I must have been probably about 6 or 7. We went to this place and in the city, like something like Rainbow's End.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were walking around, and there were these lovely paddling pools, like
beautiful
pools on this esplanade kind of beachfront. And I was walking with my mom and dad. My dad was still with us at this point, and these children frolicking in those pool, and you know, the sound of laughter in summertime. And I said, dad, you know, I want to go swim, I want to go and play in those pools. And he said, oh, you're not allowed to. Look at this sign. And there was this big sign that said European children only. And I couldn't understand it. And I said, why, Dad? Why? And he said, no, that's just the way it is. Don't question.
Right.
So I kind of, you know, forgot about it and went on with life. And obviously, being at high school, certain things were discussed about, you know, in English. They would speak about the situation, and then I learned about Nelson Mandela at that stage and all of that. And that was usually quite an impressionable time in my life that I met Gavin. And then Gavin's family rather introduced me to this whole new way of questioning and asking and probing for answers, you know, and being told the truth and being, you know, so open about it. And in my final year at school, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. So it was epic.
Yeah.
Really, really epic. And we all watched it on TV about him, you know, coming out. It was just momentous. And I think with Gavin's dad used to often encourage me, say how you feel, speak it honestly. Don't cry, because crying is sometimes seen as a point of weakness, and you can't get your words out if you cry. So tell me how you feel. Disagree with me. Shout at me if you have to, but tell me how you feel, you know?
Wow.
And so I was suddenly in this home that it was okay to question. It wasn't looked at as being disrespectful that I'm questioning stuff. And that my opinion mattered, and I kind of found my voice. And in that process of finding my voice and being suddenly aware of the world around me and the inequalities that was suddenly like in my face, I kind of started to feel, how is it that I can worship Jesus? how is it that I can have this great faith, like my ma tells me all the time, put Jesus first, don't question, you know, Jesus is God and Jesus loves you. And then I think, but hang on a sec, how the apartheid government tells me that they are the privileged few. And in my head, growing up, I almost felt like white people were superior to me. That's how in my little kid brain growing up, I felt like they were the chosen people, you know, they were beautiful. And if you didn't have blonde hair and blue eyes, then of course you didn't fit in that, you know, what was perceived to be beautiful. And then going through all of this and then suddenly being made aware of my eyes being open as to what was going on around us in South Africa, I kind of had this thing, how does Jesus love me if he's this God that loves all his people equally? How does that fit in? How can he love only some of his creation and not others? Or how does he love white people more than he loves black people or brown people? And then suddenly I kind of felt, I actually don't want to belong. I actually don't want to be a Christian. I don't want to have this faith in Jesus, because how fair is it, you know? And suddenly it was like I was just thrown into this kind of, I don't know, questions and answers. And then of course, the more I was questioning and seeking, the more my mom was suddenly afraid. And then the elders of the church would come and talk to me. And in my head, I think, I actually don't want anything to do with this. You know?
Yeah.
It's so like, wow, I feel I so understand your heart, Paula, but it's like, it so saddens me that, like, you know, this is a portrayal of Jesus in our day and age today. It's like, you know, the colonial God, and it's like, it's not our Jesus. It's not our Jesus. Oh, yeah. It's just, he so loves. And it's like, I've got nothing but empathy for your perspective. It's like, you know, it's so sad that was, you know, understandably how it was taught, it was portrayed, you know, what you've been brought up with. Like, it's tragic. It really is.
It's like, you fear God, you're gonna burn in hell. That was what I was raised with. So for a child that's impressionable and never allowed to question, never allowed to question the why things were, not being told, you know, we have this God who has such empathy and love for people, and that it, he gives us free will. People have messed it up, you know, they've made wrong choices, but that's not because Jesus doesn't love you. I was never told that. Jesus was not seen to me as, I was just seen as, if I do wrong, I'm gonna burn in the hellfire. That was my, you know, and that's it. And there's no going back. There's no second chances for me, you know? And so I think that's where I reached my crossroads in my faith. And of course, having an older boyfriend who was so politically aware of everything. Oh my God. It just kind of almost.
A bad boy.
Yes. I think I rebelled more.
Yeah.
Because I suddenly was so impressionable with all the things that he would say. And then his family was so political, and his uncle had to leave South Africa because of the political situation.
Wow.
And they had all of this background information.
Yeah.
And
I love that, because it's like, oh, our wonderful sneaky God who obviously brought you two together and had another plan.
You know, you're absolutely right, Jared. One thing I learned about and do understand now about God is that I always say, we are not meant to see the big picture. We are meant to see up to a certain point. He sees the big picture.
Yes.
So what you're saying about Paul and I getting together and going on this journey, it was his plan already. He had that plan in mind, like when Lazarus took me to church the first time. Those plans were set before I even knew it. And so
Sorry, I interrupted you, Gav. You go ahead, sorry.
No, it's good. So I just wanted to add on to what Paula said. So for me, I think I can talk as a person who was not a Christian and now is a Christian. So I can talk from two points of view. And like being not a Christian and looking at Christians, and then being a Christian and looking at non-Christians, you know, that I can see both sides of the story. One of the things that intrigued me and troubled me for many years was, number one, what Paula mentioned, that the government that we had of the day, the apartheid government, they were actually a Christian government. So when they met at parliament, they actually opened their
Christian
meetings. Christian. So the thing was, they opened in prayer, and being Christians, that's what they prayed. And I me as a non-Christian, I was thinking, because I'd been reading up quite a bit, and I was thinking to myself, how can you call yourself a Christian government if you do not follow the basic teachings of God, which is love one another? Mm-hmm. So how can you say, call yourself a Christian, but you don't practice what you preach? So for me, that didn't make sense. So that was one of my first encounters, like, this Christianity thing for me doesn't work, because they say one thing, but they do something else. So their actions don't match what they say. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first encounter. My second encounter was the fact that there were a lot of people that were sent as missionaries, and unfortunately they as well, unknowingly, I mean, they really, really loved what they did and wanted to spread the word of God. But in doing that, they believed they had to civilize or culture the people that they were coming into contact with. Not realizing that, no, you don't need to do that. You need to actually embrace the culture of the people that you want to get to know God. So they didn't understand that, and they came with their sort of Western glasses and their Western ideas, and then basically pushed it upon these people and said, this is what you should be doing. And so basically there was a big problem where people didn't understand the difference between culture and religion. And so people became embarrassed of their culture, because if you became Christian, then you had to throw out your culture, your Indian culture or your African culture or whatever culture you belong to. Mm. So because of, I'm not saying the missionaries were bad people, but they didn't understand at that time the damage they were doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it was how they were taught to spread the gospel, and they did it, I think, a lot of them with very genuine faith.
Absolutely.
And very bad teaching.
You can put it that way. So they meant good, but it didn't work out. And so I think me being a non-Christian, watching that happen, and like Paula said, I came from a family where we were very well read. My dad got up every morning at 4 o'clock and read from 4 to 6 o'clock. And then he would get up to get to work. And so, like Paula said, we were encouraged. We used to sit and debate every night. It could be on any topic. And like Paula said earlier, you had to, if you believed in something, you had to stand up and fight for what you believed in. It was great, because
I want to join.
We'd get to a point where we'd be like shouting on top of our voices. And my dad said, listen, you don't need to shout. If you want to make a point, this is how you just calm down and make your point, and we're all listening to you. Because we'd get so heated about, I mean, every person wants to, you know, sincerely believes in what they want to say. And so it was very interesting. Also the other thing was that, my family was very political, in the sense that we were very much aware of what was happening and the inequalities in our society and the damage it was doing to people. Mm. And for that reason, my dad's brother had to leave South Africa, because it became so unsafe that if you were considered a threat to the government, then you would basically be imprisoned, or you would very quietly or suddenly disappear. Mm-hmm. And no one to know anything. Mm. So, yeah, so my one memory that I can share with you today is I was at university and I was riding my motorbike to university. And it was during the student revolutions in South Africa, where mm-hmm. the students were revolting against the separate education system, because every, like we said, every race group was taught different education. And they deliberately did that because white or European people were geared to become the professionals and the managers and the CEOs. And then the other people were then either trained to become skilled laborers or become unskilled laborers. And so me as a student in high school and in university, I was fighting against the system where there was no equal opportunities for people of color. And I was riding my motorbike one morning to university and I got stopped by the army. And I had a backpack that I used to show, a shoulder bag that I had on. And the soldier pulled me over and I just clearly remember the cold metal against the temple of my forehead. He had a rifle against my forehead and he said, "Get off your motorbike." And so I got off my motorbike and they literally yanked my backpack off my shoulders and emptied out the contents of my bag on the roadside. And what happened was a week or two earlier, I had actually attended a meeting at university, and it was a meeting held by a group of people called the Black Consciousness Movement. It was started by a man called Steve Biko. And he was one of the people who mysteriously disappeared, you know, and right. was and then died unfortunately here, but it's very questionable. But what happened was I went to that meeting and they were handing out stickers, and then there was a sticker of the fist,
yeah,
which was the Black Power yeah. And mm-hmm. I never thought anything about it. I took the sticker and I put it onto my file, and the next thing these soldiers, like, they saw this file and yeah, see, he's one of them. He's a traitor. He's a traitor to our government and he needs to be put into prison. And I was thinking to myself, oh no, this is horrible. This is going wrong.
Because you must have been terrified.
Yeah, definitely.
I was terrified because the law was that you could be detained for up to 180 days in detention without your family being informed. So you would disappear.
What?
Yeah, that was
That's
the law.
Crazy.
That's nuts.
And so friends of mine actually disappeared and we'd not hear for 3 months. You would not hear anything from, you know, you'd not hear anything about them. Nobody knew where they were. And so that's what I thought was going to happen. But I was very fortunate that they asked me to remove the sticker and never to go to those meetings again. I had to promise them, kind of, and then they let me go off. But
did you go to the meetings?
Yeah, I still did.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that. Wow.
I didn't take any stickers.
Yeah.
Lesson learned.
Wow.
No evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, what an incredible context to actually grow up in, because it's like, I'm confronted often when I think about you two as a couple, and it's like there's real depth there, you know, like your calm, your beautiful exteriors, like show that soulful depth, you know, that obviously some of these circumstances and growing up in these circumstances, obviously there's been a lot of work done spiritually and to actually form you into the kind of people that you are. But I'm really curious about, like, you know, one of the other things that have really like inspired me about your story is just like, you know, your relational journey and your intimacy and your marriage journey. Like, I love hearing, you know, via the odd devotions, the stuff you've told us about actually how you've grown as a couple as well. I love that romantic side of actually you getting to know each other. And for Paula, it was such freedom as well, coming into that context. I'm also reminded of actually just like, yeah, just the merging of families and some of those dynamics is actually, you know, moving into the marital bliss as well in some of that season.
No, I was going to say, how old were you when you got married?
22.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so,
29. So to put it in the context, Christine, Paula's mom, when I approached her, so I actually went up to Paula's mom and I said, listen, I'm interested in your daughter and I would like to, you know, date her. And she asked me, she said to me, Gavin, do you realize my daughter's still a teenager? She's a baby. Yeah. And I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, what makes you want to do this? And I said, listen, the first time I met her and I looked across the room, I was busy chatting with her. Something in my mind or something in my spirit said to me that this is the woman that you should spend the rest of your life with. And I know it sounds a bit corny, but it's true.
That's adorable.
So corny.
But I went home that night and I was battling with this whole thing because, yeah, I was at university, at the motorbike, lots of girls, and, you know. Lots of girls as friends, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And I was struggling in my mind, how do I actually now, it doesn't make sense, you know, in the real world, that doesn't work. But I'm saying, I also said to myself, if I let this opportunity go, I might regret it for the rest of my life.
Right.
And so I decided to actually go to Paula's mom and just pour my heart out to her. And I did that. And but she said to me, listen,
I mean, it's so curious because, like, didn't Paula have like a similar kind of experience though as well? Like, is that true?
Yeah, Paula, you were saying you looked at him and went, this is the man. I just love that. It's just so cute. It's like a fairy tale.
So Paula's mom said to me, listen, Gavin, I just want to let you know that my daughter needs to grow up. She needs to actually experience life. And I said, and she asked me, are you prepared to wait for her? And I said, absolutely, I am prepared to wait for her. And she said to me, if you are prepared to wait for her, then it'll be fine. In about whatever number of years time, you've actually managed to wait that long, then it will be. But if you can't wait, then, you know, you might as well sort of.
That was nearly 7 years, which is so biblical, isn't it? I mean, you're Jacob waiting for your Rachel.
Yes.
But at least I got Paula. Poor Jacob didn't get
her. Yeah, that's true. He got Leah first. So,
yeah, there's not another sister or something.
Oh, wow. So were you still Hindu when you got married?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was the most interesting thing because we wanted to get married. And so the whole thing was our families loved each other. Paula's mom loved me. She didn't love the fact that I was not Christian, but she loved the fact that she loved me as a person, Gavin.
If you do say so yourself.
So the same. I loved her. And yeah, it was so religion was like sort of always in the background kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then when we decided to get married, it actually now became part of the foreground.
Yeah.
And so we had to have discussions about how we were going to get married. And so Paula, I said to her, listen, I know you're strong in your faith and I wouldn't want you to get married in a Hindu way. But at the same time, can you respect me? Because I'm not a Christian and I wouldn't want to be. I think it would be a mockery if I'm standing in church and getting married to you, but I'm not actually meaning it. It's not coming from my heart. And so I said, can't we kind of find a sort of a neutral ground in which we can get married? That started
a bit of a war. I think when Gav spoke to my mom and asked her about dating me, she said to him, you do know that we're Christian. And at the time, Gav just said, yeah, you know, I understand that. But I think how that came across to her was that I'll have no problem being a Christian when it comes to it.
Right.
That's how she saw it when he said he understood.
Right.
So our families became very, very good friends. We socialized, we did everything together. It was more just a really beautiful friendship that was developing between Gav and I. You know, I was just in awe of everything that he said and did because he was this older person. And I think,
and of course, also, you still are. I mean, everything.
And I think also, like, we look back, you know, looking, going through marriage count, you know, we did lots of marriage courses together. And I look at it now and I think, you know, Gavin being so much older than me, I think the one counselor was saying something about it's got a lot to do with the fact that my dad left when I was very young. So I kind of, that was one of the attractiveness of Gavin, and that he was older and that he babied me a lot, you know, kind of, I got this love as a boyfriend, but also he was fulfilling almost like a father's love, you know, that makes any sense in some perverted way.
No, it totally makes sense. Yep.
And so when he said, so my mom said, you know, you're going into this, Gavin, and you stand the most to lose, because if Paula comes to a point where when she's 18, she might not like the same things that she likes now. Are you prepared to invest in this and then still come out the loser? And he said yes. Wow. And in that time, culturally now, I say, speak, if a boy comes home and addresses the mum and dad, it's a given. It's looked on at that time, not now so much. At that time, it's looked on, I have serious intentions with your daughter, and those serious intentions are marriage.
And I'm giving you my word.
And I'm giving you my word that I'm coming to your home and I'm asking for her, and he'll bring his family with him, and they bring you a little gift or something. And that is to say, you know what? She's spoken for.
I mean, that's
my promise.
I mean, it's pitched as, like, you know, maybe old fashioned, you know, at, you know, at best, and maybe patriarchal at worst, but I think there's a beauty to the way in which that's actually done in some respects, because there's actually a real kind of reverence and caring for, and it's actually in terms of, if you really love someone, are you willing to pursue, are you willing to wait, are you willing to better yourself, are you willing to give them the space for them to better themselves, you know, grow and develop, not only as individuals but as a couple. Like, there's I think there's definitely some very biblical elements, biblical parallels there, and actually in how covenant monogamy and, like, courtship is done.
So when you were going to get married, and obviously, you know, the Christian stuff, it caused a bit of issues on your side. What about your family, Gavin? Were they at all like, we want a Hindu marriage? Like, what is happening here? And
They were similar, because my mom passed away when I was 16 years old, so it was just my dad, and then Paula just had a mom, and so it was a battle of the worlds, as I would say. You know, my dad wanted the Hindu wedding, and her mom and my aunties and uncles. And Paula's,
can't forget all the aunties and uncles. Gosh.
And then Paula's family wanted the Christian wedding, where she wore the white gown and walked down the aisle and kind of thing. And, like, eventually we had to come to a compromise, and then we actually had to find someone who would marry us, because back those days, nobody would want to marry a Christian and a non-Christian.
Let me put you in, previously in an Indian marriage, if you were a Christian and the groom was Hindu, you converted, you followed his way.
Right.
If he was Christian and I was Hindu, then I had to follow it. But Gavin and I decided that was not going to work for us. Because I'm not prepared to be Hindu, and he wasn't prepared to be a Christian. So we looked for people. All the Hindu priests said, no, they can't marry us. It's not going to work. All the pastors said, nope, no, they can't marry us. It's not going to work. So at the time I was attending, I used to go to a Presbyterian church. And I just found, I think I found my faith there, and that I just fell in love with the people. And it was a predominantly white church with very old people in that church. But I just kind of, I formed these lovely bonds and relationships with them. And the and Reverend Ron, he was just my favorite, you know. And he said, I would marry you, darling, but I'm away on conference. So he said, let me speak to my friend. And Reverend David Dankinson was a pastor in the Congregational Church, and he said, I won't marry them until they come for counseling. They come to me and I see them a few times, and then I'll decide.
Can I, if you don't mind me teasing that out a little bit, like what was it that enabled you to kind of come to this place? Like, I think I can kind of understand some of those reasons, but that you were so ardent about, like, no, we're going to respect each other's worldviews. We're not going to, you know, allow each other to compromise, but like, we still want to go ahead and actually proceed in this way. Can you tease that out a little bit for us? Like, how you came to that place particularly?
Because that's got to be hard.
Yeah,
it is. I think for me, it was much easier because I came from a family of where I was taught tolerance and taught to respect and understand, you know, other religions. So I grew up in a culture, well, in a family where we had Muslim friends, and we had, you know, Jewish friends and all kinds of friends. You know, it didn't really matter. It was the people that mattered, not the religion. And so for me, it was kind of easier because I didn't want to, like, being the male, I'm supposed to now ask Paula to follow me. And now I'm going against the standard of society and saying, no, I want you to be a Christian because that is your faith and that is what you believe in. I want you to remain who you are. I don't want to change that about you. So that was very interesting. And I think the same thing about Paula, she realized that if I was going to do it, I wasn't going to do it because I wanted to do it, but I was going to do it because she wanted me to do it. And then that would be the wrong reason as well.
Which is fantastic, I have to say. Like, there are a number of couples that I can think of that I won't name at all, but who you know, they really struggle with that. They're dating somebody who is a non-Christian or whatever, and most of the people in their lives are saying break up because it's not going to work if you are the whole unequally yoked and all that kind of thing. And in many cases, I would agree with it and be like, you know, no, that's not going to work. And yet you guys made it work. And then God used that as well, which a lot of people, you know, it's the whole, people talk about date to save. Have you heard of that? Where a Christian dates a non-Christian to like date to save them and bring them into, you know, and that kind of thing. And that's a really disingenuous way of being in relationship. And yet you guys didn't do that at all. But it's, you know, it's really interesting.
I think my journey was a little bit different from Gav's in terms of when we eventually did decide that we were going to get married, because obviously this relationship was going on for quite a while, you know. And when Gavin asked me to marry him, on the one hand, I was super excited because all I ever really wanted to be was Gavin's wife. And I still maintain that, I always say that, you know, that for me was my highlight. I used to say it to everybody all the time. I just want to be Gavin's wife. That's all.
Oh, that's so cute. and I
was really torn because in that time, that last year before we could get married, 1994, I gave my heart to the Lord. Like, genuinely gave my heart to the Lord, and that I found Gavin and I had gone through a really rocky part in our relationship where it was becoming a bit of a struggle, you know, this trying to work around everybody and just, you know, growing up. And obviously my faith in Jesus was cemented, where suddenly I found God and I found him for myself. And then inside of me, I said, but I love this man, Lord. And I've given so much. And I know that I was not supposed to be unequally yoked with him. But I know that after that verse, there's also that one verse that says that he will be covered by my faith. Is it in the Bible? And it wasn't as though I was taking it and making my own meaning. That I have already, although I was a Christian, I was not a believing Christian. Christian is such a loose word.
It really
I was
is, yeah.
not a believer of Jesus. I didn't believe that he owned my soul. Yeah. So when I found him and suddenly everything impacted differently for me. And I said, Lord, I am in this relationship with this man whom I love. I've given myself to him. I'm promised to him, you know, and I can't walk away now.
Yeah.
I didn't say I won't. I said, I can't.
Yeah.
And
you were committed. I mean, that's 7 years. Yeah. You were committed. That's not something you just walk away from.
And so when we were working out the wedding, I prayed and I said, Lord, I want a man of God. I want someone who believes in Jesus to marry us, regardless of how, but I want it to be a man of the church. And Gav's uncle and Gav, they looked and looked and looked for a commissioner of oath. You know, because that's what they wanted. They wanted somebody who was neither
sort of a civil marriage.
They looked, and I said, Lord, they're not going to find that person. They won't find it because God's going to grant me that desire that there will be a man of the church that will marry us, and a reverend married us. And that's when awesome. We went for counseling, asked Gavin, he said, if you can give me a man's word that you will not force Paula to do anything that, you know, any rituals or anything, you will not force her to give up her love for Jesus and her faith. If you can give me that promise as a man, then I will go ahead and I'll marry you. After so many, and then he spoke to us.
And then
about
he also asked me, have you ever thought about children? And I said, yep. And then he said, so when your children are born, what faith will they follow? And I said, listen, between Paula and I admire her because she's so strong in her faith, and I would love for my children to be Christian. And he said, are you sure? He said, I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, number one, I would never ever stop Paul from going to church. Number two, I'd love my children to be raised as Christian. And so I made that promise there and then. And then years later, when all three of our children were born, and when all three of them were born, I was still not a Christian. I stood in front of a congregation at church, and we dedicated our children, and I promised the congregation that I would bring up my children as a Christian, in the Christian faith.
You know what? I reckon there were a whole bunch of Christians that were around you that were all going, God's got him. We're just waiting.